You do need someone who has some like comedy relief, because I think that a lot of veterans miss that camaraderie. Like the job sucks. The job just grinds you into the ground. But the one thing you miss right off the bat is the guy who does talk about like, "Hey guys, I don't know what's going on this weekend, but I got a case of Four Locos. We'll stick to the apartment, and I just need to unwind for a little bit." And you're like, done.
To all who shall see these presents, greetings. I'm Adam Best. This is Veterans in the Wild. Welcome to another show, ladies and gentlemen. We have Chris Jackson. He is a 2009 graduate of the United States Naval Academy, a surface warfare officer, did 5+ years active duty, turned to the Navy Reserves. And we are happy to have him here. Welcome, Chris.
Great to be here. Thanks, Adam, for inviting me on board.
I think that's the most serious 10 seconds we've ever had together.
We've had an incredible, incredible history together. Not going to lie, man.
So one of the first things you said when I was asking you questions about, like, what could we talk about on a show, you said, "I always wanted to join the Navy ever since I was a little kid." Was that a family tradition? Was that just interest in military, being at sea? What was that?
I would like to think that the reason why I liked the military so much was because, and why I was so interested at the very beginning age, because, so my grandfather was a tank commander for the 7th Cavalry in World War II. He actually landed on Normandy in the evening after the initial invasion to invade France. And he was wounded several days later. He was a Purple Heart recipient. And I think that's what drove my dad into the military. And also he had some good friends that went to the Naval Academy. So I am a legacy Academy grad. My dad was an 81 grad. And then I was an 09 grad. And then my brother was a 12 grad. So we have a long lineage in the military. Absolutely wouldn't change a thing. But from the very beginning, I just remember seeing how much fun my dad had as, you know, a naval aviation. He was actually an NFO. And I just remember how much fun he had and all the people I got to interact with. Little did I know that those guys, you know, that I was playing, you know, Super Nintendo and N64 with would later go on be like the COs of squadrons and whatnot. And I just attracted me at the very beginning and realized that I wanted to join the military. And I really didn't know what I wanted to actually do until after 9/11. And I realized that, you know, as a kid in high school, seeing what was happening and what was going on, that I was 100% going to join the Navy, and I didn't care what anyone told me. So
the Navy specifically or the military?
The Navy specifically, because my initial like dream was to be a Navy SEAL. So I was, grew up in Colorado Springs. I was a military brat, so I was actually born in California. But traveling all over the United States as a kid, as a military brat, my dad did, you know, 20+ years. And I knew I wanted to be a Navy SEAL. The Air Force had a lot of great opportunities. It's a good school. But at the same time, I had my heart set on becoming a Navy SEAL. And kind of got me to where I am today. Unfortunately, not a SEAL. But the life experiences and the route that I took definitely worked out for the better.
And Colorado Springs is home of an institution, is it not?
Colorado Springs is where the Air Force Academy is. It's also home to numerous military bases and installations, and not one of them are Navy. So luckily, my dad got a really awesome joint tour at NORAD, which actually put us in Colorado. And then that's, no kidding, my hometown. I consider it my hometown. And we have numerous Army bases, numerous Air Force bases, but luckily NORAD is why we were there. And we got to stay there for a really good long time.
Awesome. And so one of my next questions was, you said 9/11 was a big impact on you joining the military. What do you remember from that day? One of the questions I don't ask a lot of people, but I want to start asking people is, I think our parents' generation was, where were you when Kennedy was killed? Where were you when we landed on the moon? I think our generation's question is, where were you on September 11th? Well, what you said, it had an impact on you, and could you talk a little bit more about that?
So I was kind of a nerd in high school. No kidding. I would actually go to the library every day in the morning so I could finish up homework, start working on things that I hadn't done the night before.
Or so you were always a procrastinator.
Did I always get my homework done? Yes. Did I always struggle with academics? Yes. So I was, no kidding, the kid who sat in the front of the class. I was the kid who sat in class after school. I always went to the extra, like, curricular, or not extracurricular activities, but the extra study sessions. And no kidding, every teacher knew who I was because I was the kid who always raised his hand because I needed extra help. I struggled academically in high school, and I actually struggled academically in the Naval Academy. Weird, because academics doesn't come easily to me, so I have to work that much harder. And so being in the library is not nothing new to me, but I remember on September 11th, no kidding, I'm sitting in the library and everyone's being drawn to the TV. I never look at the TV. So I'm like, why is everyone sitting by the TV? I'm like thinking to myself, maybe that there's some big news with the Denver Broncos is actually what I was going through my mind. I'm like, everyone's like
being
drawn to something, you know, God, please don't tell me something happened. Oh man. Like, please don't tell me they're moving to Vegas or something stupid like that. But it didn't dawn on me until I actually got to my first period class that I sat down, the TV was on, and then I thought, oh my gosh, what's going on? And I saw the two towers, and I remember thinking, I'm like, I know those are in New York, but I don't understand why they're on fire. And probably 15 minutes later, after our teacher told us that, you know, two planes had crashed into it, probably about 15 minutes after we started watching, I saw the first tower fell. And it was surreal. And I was in shock for a good 45 minutes to an hour after that. I just had no idea how to comprehend. I'm just a kid in high school. And it just didn't feel real. I still thought it was just a horrible accident. Later on that day, after the second tower fell, then my history teacher at the time actually sat down and told us what terrorism was. And I just remember being angry. I just felt really, really angry because I flew a lot. You know, I just remember, you know, as a kid flying when, you know, basically my parents would drop me off at the terminal. And then my brother's 4 years younger than me. My brother would, you know, kind of follow me, and I knew how to get to the gate so that we could, you know, our grandparents or aunt and uncle would pick us up at the gate. And I just remember thinking, like, man, if I was on that plane, like, what would my brother do? Like, he'd be terrified. And I just remember being angry. And then once, after the next few years of me actually going through the history of Afghanistan, you know, our time in Afghanistan, the Russians' time in Afghanistan, I got angrier and angrier. And I just kind of solidified my impact on our American society that I was going to join the military and I was going to go after these guys, because there's absolutely no reason why this should happen in a modern society. I thought we were beyond this, and it was a direct threat to anybody who took democracy seriously.
I like it. You said you struggled academically and went to the Naval Academy. Did you get a an early invitation?
I had a 5-year plan. did not become a doctor. So
I have to pause. I don't remember. I know two Naval. Did you or another guy remember go to the NAPS?
I went to NAPS.
I wanted to talk about NAPS because I don't think a lot of listeners know about it, or you had the perspective of what was that like? What was that like to be part of NAPS versus the incoming class? Was that helpful to have that leg up?
So the Naval Academy Preparatory School, NAPS, is located in Newport, Rhode Island. It was essentially established as a entry-level education opportunity for enlisted personnel who are coming out of the fleet to go into the Naval Academy. So we have a lot of really incredible enlisted personnel that put in applications to become officers via the Naval Academy. And they have been out of practice of, you know, educational study, essentially, like, you know, going through the normal routine of sitting down and doing your research papers or sitting down through a class, and to try to set them up better for success for the guys who have been out of, you know, the school environment for a while. We set up this program called NAPS to help them better, like, you know, transition from the fleet into the academy. Yes. It's a 1-year program. I was a seaman apprentice for 12 months. And when I was brought in, it's used still primarily for enlisted personnel coming out of the fleet, but it's also a big program for guys like me who were just, I was within that threshold between my SAT scores and my GPA of just being just under where I was to get in my first go around and not be on, and I was on a standby list, but the standby list got filled. So they offered me an appointment to the preparatory school. So preparatory school is used by 2 institutions, the Coast Guard Academy and the Naval Academy. And we had, I want to say it was just over 300 applicants and 300 candidates. And we were all midshipman candidates. And we went through an entire year, a trimester of our basic, what we'd see our freshman year of college. And that was calculus, chemistry, physics, English, different levels of history classes. And we were just broken down into 2, obviously, trimesters. And we had to take the classes. We had to show up and we had to maintain a specific GPA. And then even after we maintained that specific GPA, we still were just eligible to be appointed into our prospective academies, whether it was Coast Guard or the Naval Academy. We had a lot of guys who graduated from the prep school who didn't get appointments to the Academy or the Coast Guard just because they had honor violations, they had academic violations, or they just, no kidding, we had one kid, he had like a 3.2 GPA his first trimester, 3.3 his second, and then he had like a 1.5 because he just didn't care. He's like, hey, I still have a 2.5 or whatever it averaged out to. I can't remember. He's like, I'm still good. And they're like, yeah, no, you have the maturity level of an idiot and you're not going to go. And so they kicked him out.
So it's almost as if you enlist for the year.
We do. So I actually took an oath of enlistment. I have a DD-214 that showed I had a pre enlistment, which was kind of cool because it counted towards retirement. And no kidding. Yeah, I did 1 year at the Naval Academy Preparatory School. I'm so glad I did because chemistry and physics both kicked my butt when I got to the academy. I was good with calculus. I was not good with chemistry. It really did kick my butt.
I hated the chemistry. Yeah.
It doesn't make sense.
Mm-mm. It's fake. It's fake. I agree.
It's all made up.
Glad we, yeah. we have decided it is fake.
I mean, physics, when you really think about it, you can't push a rope. F equals ma. You know, gravity is 9.8 meters per second squared. But chemistry is just, it really is just made up.
Yeah, they say the neutron could be here, it could be there, the proton's maybe going to happen. Did you have any friends that joined you from NAPS at the Academy?
I did. Oh, in terms of like transitioning from NAPS to the Academy?
Yeah, you and Tim went directly to school together.
Yes. So I had in my company, so each company, there's at the time we had 30 companies. My company had about a dozen Napsters. My roommate from NAPS actually was my roommate for the first few weeks at the academy. He quit. He just said he just couldn't take it anymore. So he got out. But we had, I mean, I played baseball at prep school, which was awesome because I got to play at the JUCO level. And then I had about a dozen in my company. And of that dozen, 10 of us finished all the way to completion for graduation. I had so many great friends that I graduated prep school with that I went on to the academy with, still stay in good contact with them. And yeah,
Well, I guess I was trying to ask, did two lost sailors show up at the Naval Academy together, have a friend at their lost Naval Academy experience on day one? Yeah. I mean, was that an advantage that NAPS gave you, that someone showing up by themselves as a plebe?
Oh, yes. So it was kind of cool because we actually showed up several days earlier than all the high school kids showed up. I say kids, but the adults that were showing up for college. So no kidding. We showed up at Snapsters. We showed up a few days earlier. We went through the entire cycle and we were kind of like the dry run for all the cadre. So the cadre who run plebe summer at the Naval Academy are all going to be seniors at the Naval Academy. And that's kind of like their detail, is to, you know, run plebes for the next plebe summer. You have two sets, first set, second set. And we ran through just kind of like how long it's going to take, what are their, you know, when we're getting issued all of our gear, all of our uniforms, haircuts, how long does it actually take us from point A to point B? You know, once we get, you know, 100 pounds of all the crap they give us, you know, how long does it take us to walk from where we're issued to our rooms? And it's a lot easier when guys know how to use your uniforms, guys know how to, you know, step to the line. Yes, sir. No, sir. Yes, ma'am. No, ma'am. Salute. Good. Go. And it's obviously we had just done, you know, 1 year of hazing before that. So we're a little bit more choreographed, into the, you know, the rules and regulations of, you know, naval traditions. But, yes. In terms of showing up and knowing somebody, I could look to my left, look to my right. I'm like, hey, what's up, dude? Hey, what's up, dude? And then when the guys, the new kid showed up, the guys from high school, like just deer in the headlights looked like, I could be like, hey, slow down, take a breath. This is how you put on these shoes. This is how you put these creases in the uniform. This is how you make your rack, as opposed to like the cadre just like beating you down with 100 push-ups and that kind of good stuff. Like, It was nice to take. It was nice for someone to look up to me, and be like, "How do I do this?" And I could just calmly tell them, "This is how we do it." And it was really cool.
Yep. Was there a commitment if you did not get an appointment out of NAPS?
So, what do you mean? As in, like, if I left NAPS and didn't want to go to the Naval Academy, there's no commitment.
Nothing. You just walk away as a phone.
Just walk away as a phone.
Hmm.
Awesome. We had a lot of people do that. They're just like, heck with this military life.
Yeah, I just didn't know that. It was basically saying like, you're going to list, you either get there or you're going to the fleet.
The only real commitment that you have coming out of either NAPS or coming out of the Naval Academy is, so NAPS, there's no commitment. For the Naval Academy, the first day of your junior year at the Naval Academy, you owe them, we call them 2 for 7s. So basically you sign your name, like I will complete the next junior and senior year and do 5 more years after that.
Yep.
And if I don't, Uncle Sam is going to collect a massive paycheck from me.
Yep. All right. And you graduated.
Graduated. I did.
You did?
I did.
Are we sure?
I'm pretty sure.
Pretty sure.
I have a diploma and a transcript that says I completed said course of study.
With your full name?
Yes.
Social security number? Has this been like run through like a verifying agency?
I want to say that it was verified.
Chris Jackson is a pretty common name. So
it
is. Maybe I get it.
If I joke, I'm not going to say my my email address over the podcast, but there are so many Christopher Jacksons in the Navy that they've started like adding numbers and hyphenating my last name.
Awesome. So you graduated. Was it a 5-year plan? Do you think you're going to retire from the Navy?
I was going to play it by ear. So I had a lot of really awesome mentors that flew with my dad or worked with my dad, either at the Naval Academy in the surrounding Annapolis area. And they,
N4 for the crowd?
What's that?
Can you tell the crowd what's an N4?
An N4? Mentor.
A mentor.
So I had a lot of mentors when I was there, whether they sponsored me, whether they, you know, take me in for the weekend, because we weren't allowed to own anything while we're at the academy. You spend all 4 years in the same dormitory. Your first 2 years, you're not allowed to own any civilian clothes. The first year, you're not actually allowed to leave the grounds except for one day every 2 weeks. So we were pretty locked down for quite a while. So when I say sponsor, essentially you have families and people that are living in Annapolis and surrounding area. They'll basically take on midshipmen for like the weekend, give them a place to like just crash on the couch, watch Sports Center, and take a nap. Is really all you really wanted to do. But no kidding, I had a couple sponsors that took me in that flew with my dad, and they did 25 years. One of them did 5 years, and then did another 20 in the reserves. So their perspectives were completely different in terms of like when you should get out, but they all said the same thing. Like, it's, you know, when it's time to get out, whether it's 25 years, 5 years, you know, when it's time to get out. And for some people, it was because of family, others, it was just burnout. And then others, they all knew when it was about that time. And, but they all had a fun time. Not one of them said they regret anything about it. They just said it was an experience. And once it ran its course, it ran its course.
Yep. My last watch in the Navy was driving OD from home from our Mesa Verde deployment.
Yeah.
I literally did that, walked off, went on terminal leave, and
I was there.
Yes, you were. Starting though, I don't know if everyone knows, Chris and I were, I hate to say peers because I don't know if I want to say.
Well, peers. You were a big bad GAG and I was just a lonely ensign.
He's saying big because I'm heavier than he is, folks.
No. Because you were a big bad O2 and I was just a lonely O1.
Yes, I had continued to breathe for 2 years and got my promotion. So we did our deployment. We were both JOs on Mesa Verde in our 2010 deployment. We deployed. We thought we were heading across the pond, and then they told us, why don't you guys take a right? We went down to Haiti, and you said it was a really memorable part of your career. Can you tell us a little bit more about what we did, what happened? Why in the world they sent a Navy ship down to an island that had a major disaster?
So we were the first naval ships. I can't remember which hospital ship was there before us. I can't remember if it was the Mercy or the Comfort.
Comfort.
I have to go back. It was the Comfort?
Yeah.
So it was the Comfort was there, but the Comfort really didn't have a whole lot of helicopter like options for their medevac platform. And so we were the first, like, I think we were the first ARG, if I remember correctly, to actually be in there. And then like Tortuga and Ashland were shortly thereafter.
Yep.
But no kidding, every single port, pier, and facility was destroyed in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. And the Haitians were just in a really bad spot. And so when you think of amphibious warfare, one of our big doctrines is HADR, humanitarian aid and disaster relief. And we were the perfect platform to support any type of relief efforts or medevac efforts that were going on throughout the island. So Haiti back in 2010, I believe is actually the very beginning of January, that this massive earthquake just rocked the island, and any type of infrastructure that wasn't like to like California code of, you know, earthquake proofing, which I believe was only one building, and that was the hospital, actually withstood the earthquake.
Yep.
And we were there within several days of the earthquake. And I remember we were actually, you and I were transiting the Atlantic, and we did a hard right down south to go help them out. And we were there for probably about 3 weeks.
Yep.
And you were running the bridge and the helicopter operations, and I was doing a lot of small boat recces, where essentially I was taking small boats in and out of, like we were going through all kinds of little inlets, lagoons, beaches, anything that we could find that would be a good landing spot, because we had no intelligence in terms of like beach landing areas. So there was no place to put LCACs. There's no places to put LCUs that we knew of that were actually approved. So I spent several days going in and out looking for areas that were safe that we could actually land an LCAC or an LCU to put Marines ashore. And I never put humanitarian aid or disaster relief on my list of things that I was going to do in the Navy. I was so concerned about the Russians. I was so concerned about Afghanistan and Iraq, that I did not even think for a second that I would be involved with trying to just get water to people who are in desperate need of just potable water.
And that was something I guess I didn't really consider, was that I knew what we were doing there. You know, I knew what I had to do on the ship. I knew what people were doing ashore. I guess, though, I didn't realize maybe the multiple phased approach the Navy had already set up. You know, they sent us there because we were the first ship ready. We could do the mission. They sent us down there. And then I guess I hadn't considered, okay, then they're going to send more reliefs. Then there's the next consideration. So I guess I really didn't realize what all, I knew what you guys were doing, but I guess I didn't see the larger plan of, okay, the reason you need to find a place LCACs can land, is it because Mesa Verde and our ships or our group is not going to land LCACs?
Right.
The next people we're going to send down, they're going to know where they can land LCACs.
And on top of that, there's so much mystery, because I don't even think we had a beach group that was set up just to, like, you know, to certify the beaches, because yep. a lot of the debris that was fouling a lot of the places that were approved for LCACs, whether it was like massive like chunks of cement or just, you know, basically instead of having a beach, there's now like a disaster area. Because I remember once we set up there, we had a lot of headbutting with NGOs, because we had several that were the professional NGOs that showed up, and they were just at their distribution centers. Then you had some other NGO who would just show up with like a pickup truck of water or food and just start throwing into a crowd, and they would start creating chaos. And I remember RCO Nokane talked about like, we must be patient, we must be responsible, because when you have people that are desperate, if you just start throwing water into a crowd, they're going to start fighting each other over a single pot of water. But if it's patient and responsible and just calm everything down, you can get through thousands of people over the next, you know, several hours, as opposed to several hundred desperate people who are going to try to kill themselves and each other to get to your supplies that you're just, you know, ad hoc throwing into them. And I remember we had that happen several times. We had intel briefs about that. And that's kind of, that put a bad taste in my mouth about NGOs. I'm like, okay, what is an NGO? Is it a professional group of people who do this every now and then? Or is it like just some, like, you know, group of like activists who just want to like take like a weekend and drive down to Haiti and, you know, put it on the resume that I was part of an NGO. Okay, well, if you do that kind of stuff, it has to be professional. It has to be responsible. Because if you don't, then you get in these situations like this.
Yep. And what I also remember, I think, pulling out from North Carolina once we picked up the Marines, we're ready to deploy. We started heading east. That's deployment. And then like, nope, turn south. And that was my second deployment. I was kind of used to this kind of thing. But like a normal deployment is you leave, you transit. It's a 13-day transit. That's normally the standard requirement. You get over there. You do some port hops throughout the med. It's great. You're like, ah, this is cool. You know, the Navy like warms you up like, ah, cool, we're sitting in Europe. Ours, though, was like we started and they're like, you're deployed. Go to an operational mission that the world needs, like right now. Not like you guys are deployed assets. You're sitting off the coast of North Carolina. Like, I thought I was a deployed asset, like, when I went through the Suez Canal, you know.
Ooh, good point.
Yeah, like, you get to the southern point of the Suez Canal, you're like, all right, we're here. This is where I don't, like, I liked being in Europe. I liked being in the U.S. You get to the bottom part of the Suez Canal, and you're like, all right.
Now, you see, basically, extremely dire, desperate people on, like, day two of deployment.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was, to me, I guess, like, I knew what deployment was, but they were like, you're a deployed asset, even though you're sitting off the, you know, 30 miles off of the United States, or I don't know where we were, but, like, yeah, you're going that way. For me, that was, I guess, maybe I felt like I had more perspective, but it was still cool to see or to experience, like, yeah, you're a deployed asset.
You no, need absolutely. To no, absolutely. And also, like, between the briefs, between, you know, I believe we had briefs from Red Cross. We had briefs from State Department. We had personnel that were like jumping from, we had like those triage units that were jumping back and forth between different ships. Yep. Oh yeah. We had the full gambit of people who were trying to help the Haitians like from day one. Yep. And it was eye opening just how much, how many people were like jumping to go and help those people. And it was an incredible experience. I wish we had stayed a little bit longer, but once, like you said, those contingency efforts came after us, they were the brick and mortar that was going to stay there and help them for the long term. We were just there for relief. We weren't there for, like, you know, the long game.
Yeah, that was cool to see, because we got to be the first responders in that sense, like the first people on the scene, but we weren't meant to be there because we were heading east.
Yeah, we had theater level stuff that we had to go and address.
So jumping ahead, you went after Mesa Verde. You did two deployments on Mesa Verde, and then you went on to a River Run group. Can you tell people what a River Run group does and what your time was like there?
So for my second tour, I was selected to go and serve as an assistant officer in charge of a riverine squadron when it was a brown water focused squadron. We basically took over for the Fast Company, which was a small riverine boat group out of the Marine Corps. And after Vietnam, let me back up a little bit. So Vietnam, you see a lot of those PBRs, those patrol boat, riverine, like the small green boats throughout, you know, whatever movie you want to see from Vietnam or an action movie you want to see. But they were the patrol boats that would go in between the Mekong deltas looking for Viet Cong or North Vietnamese. And they would go after like smuggling or any time of personnel transfers or armament transfers in Vietnam. That's where we trace our roots to. Well, after Vietnam, you know, the Navy really was trying to draw back, and they turned over the mission to the Marine Corps. So the Marine Corps still had a huge desire to keep it until midway through Iraq. And once budgets started getting tight, they realized they didn't want to keep the small boat companies, and they turned it back over to the Navy, which took over, and we used it because, one, we liked it. Two, it was an awesome opportunity for expeditionary and kind of like direct action missions for non-conventional craft. I say non-conventional because everyone that worked at the riverine units were not SWCC. They weren't SEALs. So you have your unconventional assets like SWCC and small boat units. And they were actually the ones doing the crazy SEAL missions. We were doing the conventional missions, which was like Haditha Dam or going through the different rivers through Iraq. And we were supporting direct action missions in terms of whether it's Marines or Army. We were patrolling the rivers all over Iraq. And we deployed three different squadrons. So Riverine Squadrons 1 and 2 were out of Little Creek, Virginia. Riverine Squadron 3 was out of Yorktown. And all three squadrons deployed to Iraq continuously for several years until I got there. Once I got there, all hell broke loose. But at the time, day one, it's over. This show's over. So it was an all male unit, and we were still very heavily involved with brown water, what we call brown water. But at the time, President Obama was starting to draw down on Iraq missions. And so probably about 6 months before I was supposed to deploy to Iraq, they canceled it. And I remember I knew I was in a different group of people in terms of sailors, because all of our sailors were minemen, gunner's mates, bosun mates. We didn't have any SWIC guys. It was all just your expeditionary type of guys, CVs. And I remember our OIC came to us and said, "Hey guys, we gotta go tell the guys we're not deploying to Iraq." And I was totally bummed. And I remember thinking to myself, I just did two deployments with the amphibs. I guarantee the guys are gonna be bummed that they're not deploying, but I didn't realize they were gonna be devastated. So when the OIC came to us and told us that we weren't going to go to Iraq because they were drawn down, and the last, I believe, Riverine Squadron 1 was still there, but they were just basically going to leave all their stuff in place, the guys were devastated. They wanted to go to Iraq so bad. I had numerous Iraq veterans that had done the first Riverine Squadron 2 plank owner deployments to Iraq, and they were devastated. They wanted to go back. They were motivated. They were excited. They wanted to go back. And they were going to get that opportunity. So instead, we got from higher that they're going to give us a bigger boat, and they wanted us to go more into the green water. And so the green water is your Persian Gulf. It's not really, it's more of like just beyond the littorals, but not much river stuff. And so we basically got a bigger boat, and instead of going into the rivers, we still did the brown water pipeline. We also did the littoral pipeline, which where we were actually going into coastal areas and over the horizon capabilities. And that was kind of cool, because once we went to my third deployment, which was the Persian Gulf, we actually deployed in response to Iran. And we were doing more of a FAC-FIAC mission and supporting CENTCOM and all the missions throughout Bahrain that we're going to mess with Iran for a little bit and basically counter their FAC-FIAC opportunities.
Yeah.
Or I'm sorry, not opportunities, capabilities.
Awesome. But that's a pretty quick response to that. The Navy sort of had to flex and say, okay, we're canceling this one. We have the assets. What do we do with them?
Exactly. And that was the thing. It's like, we already had these capabilities, but we needed to have a request. So we need to have your RFF. So your request for forces, and CENTCOM and Fifth Fleet was asking for it. So they needed something to counter the FAC-FIAC capabilities that were pressing on U.S. Navy assets in the region. And you basically had this group of people who were just like, we'll do that. We can be there tomorrow. Really. All of our boats were capable of being air transported, so why not? So we had assets and teams in Abu Dhabi, and we had assets in Dubai, and we just needed to pull the trigger, and we did. And I did 6.5 months in Manama, and had a great opportunity to stress and exercise my, the last 6 months of training that I went through. So the Riverine Pipeline, I say pipeline, but we started off with Expeditionary Combat School in Gulfport, Mississippi. And we did, I think it was like 3 weeks there. But after that, it was all like Marine Corps heavy, infantry heavy kind of training, where we went through a Riverine Combat School, where we basically learned your Riverine 101. And then after that, it branched off into the guys who are going to be like drivers. So you had your coxswain course, and you had your unit level leadership course, which was all the officers and maybe a few chiefs, but no kidding, it was down and dirty. This is how you build your op wards. This is how you practice your call for fires. We did all kinds of stuff like that. And it was a good 6 months of just learning the job. And obviously it was important to me because I loved it and I enjoyed it and I learned a lot from it. And then after the Navy decided to scrap the program, we had the Seri Island incident back in 2012? Yeah, 2012. And that was all a big fallout from, well, when you stop training people, then they screw up really bad.
Yep.
And I won't go into that much more than that, because my opinions are
yours.
Very, very sharp about that.
So you, I think I understood it right. You were ready to deploy for mission one that got scrapped. So you had to retrain for, sounds like 6 months, and then deployed.
So the 6 month pipeline was before I even showed up to the 6 month pipeline was specifically for my personal development. And well, no, it was the basic phase.
Was the first deployment delayed to train for the second new mission?
So the 6 months that I trained for was the normal, like the normal, like pipeline for all the newly, God, what's the word for it? Once I got orders, you had to go through the 6 months as an officer before you can show up and report to the debt.
Yeah.
And then once I got to the debt, we were training through our basic phase to go to Iraq. That got scrapped, and then it turned into that into more of a littoral, kind of like with N7. You know, basically they said, hey, we'll do the rivers, but we're also going to have to add this littoral stuff on top of that just to make sure you guys are ready for when you actually go to 5th Fleet.
I guess that's what I was asking this. How long did that new transition take?
That took, I want to say that probably took like at least 6 months.
Yeah, makes sense. I mean, you couldn't just deploy and then add on stuff while you're over there.
We could have, but I would prefer not to. I think that's just a terrible idea. And the OJT kind of thing, it's cool, but sounds great on paper, but it's really not in good practice.
Well, yeah, because you were taking on an entirely different
role.
Yes. So my favorite part of the Navy, being on two big gray floaty things out in the middle of the ocean, was being the officer of the deck. Especially officer of the deck. For everyone listening, officer of the deck's more of, it's the officer in charge of where the ship goes, getting the ship to where it needs to be, and executing what needs to happen on board a ship to keep it running properly. What would you say, Chris, was your favorite job on board a big gray floaty thing? And or like, did you prefer engineering more? My favorite, like, I want to say it was actually getting a ship, like taking it from tied up pier side to underway. But then, you know, you just took a ship to sea. Seeing anchor coming home is much cooler than that. But I would say the coolest thing for like a true like surface warfare officer, like, is probably like underway replenishment. That you're tied to another ship, you're about 200 feet away. A lot of stuff can go wrong. A lot of things can happen very quickly. What were your thoughts, or what do you look back on the big gray things, and what did you enjoy the most?
I think the biggest things I appreciated the most, I definitely, when I was standing at EL and just like, you know, trying to figure out how to correct list. So list is obviously for listeners, like when you guys, when you think of a car, your car is always like centered. You don't really have it leaning left or leaning right unless you're turning. Well, with ships, especially when you're like using fuel, eventually you're going to have to take it from ballast tanks and fuel tanks, and you're going to just shift from one side to the other, the port starboard. So to correct the list, you actually have to transfer fuel. But if you don't do it correctly, then the list gets overcorrected, and then you have a much farther lean to one side or the other. So doing the math, try to correct something, and then also planning for when you're going to take the fuel, because you have to do fuel transfer in the next few hours to make up for the fuel you've already used and burned. The math is kind of cool. And I remember the first time I ever did that, I actually took fuel from the wrong side, so I actually made the list worse. So I had to actually ballast to counter where the fuel was taken, and it really wasn't a big deal, but obviously we weren't in any danger. But at the same time, just that small mathematical error caused me a lot more problems, and obviously I owned up to it immediately and had to call the captain and tell him I started taking suction off the wrong side of the ship, because the list went from like half a degree to 1 degree, and you're just like, come on, Chris. And I was like, damn it. But no, luckily I was, we deal with amphibs, so we have the ballast capabilities. So if you do take it from the wrong side, you can ballast, as opposed to the small boys like your frigates, cruisers, and destroyers, where you have to comp water. So you really don't have that opportunity to compensate. So yep. I would say being the EO was absolutely an incredible experience. I would say my most memorable experience was medevacing a guy who had, cut off the end of his hand, and he had to get medevaced off to Italy. And I was essentially in the middle of the night trying to, coordinate with the ambulance and the hospital on the shore with, CO was talking to the embassy, and I was trying to keep the ship from, crashing into fishing boats who were obviously drunk with how they were driving. And I was trying to keep the ship safe. And I remember the first day, I'm sure the CO did the same thing with you, Adam, but I remember Combat Larry used to say, welcome to your next responsibility, but here's the thing, there's 1,300 people that are directly under your safety and mm-hmm. your responsibility. Please keep us safe and be responsible. No kidding. We had 335 sailors-ish and just over 800 Marines on board. So we had flex between 1,100 and 1,300 people, depending on when people were transferring or reporting on board. And all those people were directly under my supervision when we were OD.
Yep.
And that's kind of, if you think of Titanic, the people who screwed it up really bad. obviously we didn't hit any icebergs, so I think we're all right. But that a lot of those emergencies went through my mind once I came to terms with just how many people's lives and how many families they are connected to. If I screwed this up, they'd be in dire straits.
Yeah. I was a guest on a podcast where I was trying to tell a civilian what that was like the very first time I took the deck. So it was on a destroyer, and it was from another buddy, one of my best friends from that ship. But I remember literally we talked about everything we needed to. I had all the information. I understood, I was comfortable, and it got to the point where even I knew that I was delaying, and he knew I was delaying, because I just started BSing with him at that point. And I still he'll still call me out on this, because he knows he was the guy who gave me my first watch. He turned it over to me, and he's like, "Yeah, remember how freaking long you took to finally just go, I got it?" He's like, "Yeah, you had all the information." He's just like, he's like, "I have to keep this until you take it from me. I can't give this away. It's my deck until you take it." And I remember, kind of like you said, when you think about the families, or you think about, I guess for destroyers, 270 people, but still, 10 people. When you think about I could F up a lot of people's lives tonight if I don't do this right.
And that's what really drives me crazy when I see these after action reports of whether it's the Guardian, USS Guardian, when they ran aground, or the Fitzgerald, McCain. You just read this stuff, you're like, what is wrong with these people? The Guardian especially, I read the after action reports, and I just, you see this and just the bare minimum 101 of like just safe seamanship, yep, which is not adhered to. And it just drives you crazy. Yep. In fact, for your listeners, I affiliated with the reserves after active duty. And I, one of the biggest things I talk about, especially when I do my annual training with active ships that are with Command Third Fleet, so as they work up in their basic phase when they're going through PMINT, FIBRON Marine integration exercises, I talk about those case studies. And a lot of the junior officers, they know of the case studies, but they haven't actually like read those case studies. And I harp on every single watch station. I'm like, have you heard about this? Have you heard about this? I'm like, yeah, I kind of heard about it. I'm like, well, we're going to talk about it. And then you can see their eyes open like, holy smokes, how did they miss that? I'm like, well, when it's 2 a.m. and you're on month 4 of deployment, sometimes these things happen and it's unacceptable because you have a responsibility as a mariner to do these kind of things and they didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a buddy from our ship, went on to his next ship. They had a department head as their OOD through the, not to sue us, the Straits of Hormuz. And for everyone listening, you can see two junior officers just laughing at the stupidity of that because it just doesn't make sense. Like, yeah. Well, what the listener should understand is that the person they put in charge did have plenty of experience, but he'd been inexperienced and he hadn't been doing it for a while. To have someone... Yes, to have someone who is doing it more often would be a junior person, but they do it, you know, 4 times a week, 8 times a week versus someone who probably hadn't done it for 6 months or does it once every 3 months, every 6 months, every 10 months. So the command perspective of putting someone in there that had more time, more experience, and more seniority at that point was ultimately probably proven to be a wrong decision. And instead of going with a junior person who was just more, you know, was truly the person that should be doing the job.
Agreed.
Yeah. Moving on. We are neither of us are active duty naval officers. When I got out, I lost what I would now admit is like a, you kind of feel like you lose part of your identity. You feel like I graduated high school. I went to college. I'm a naval officer. I left the Navy. Now who the hell am I? It's very common that there's like a loss of like self-worth. There's a lot of transition issues. The military does a decent job, a much better job than many private companies do, but... Did you have any, that's my dog wanting, did you have any challenges in your transition?
I 100% had challenges in my transition. For the listeners, my wife is active duty. And once we started running the numbers, running the scenarios of, you know, where her career goes and where my career goes, my wife was several years ahead of me. We just did not want to play the Geo Bachelor games. We had just gotten married and we were doing shore duty and no kidding. We wanted a family, but we also knew the challenges of doing the Geo Bachelor where she would go somewhere and I would go somewhere.
So if you both kept naval careers.
Yeah, if we both kept naval careers. And so we decided to go with her career. And then that meant I was going to be more of the dependent, you know, dependent role where I basically would stay home and I would just kind of follow in her wake. And it worked out for the better because I was able to transition into different types of veteran communities in terms of forums. I had an alumni association I could fall back onto. But even then, like you said, I had a purpose kind of identity crisis where instead of being part of a organization, I was part of a role. And I had to completely take away that focus of an organization and just take on just the role. And so my mission was originally as a U.S. Naval officer to wave the flag wherever the Constitution declares and, you know, basically project power in a maritime environment. Now it was support your family no matter what. And you say, and I say that because it's a much different responsibility. It's a much different role. And I remember leading sailors into harm's way. And now I'm changing diapers. So it was a much different role. I had an absolute blast watching my little girls grow up. But it definitely took several scoops of humble pie to eat before I realized that. And I was looking for jobs that I was overly qualified for because they're more easily conducive to being in a dependent kind of role because of dependent hours. And this is all like pre-COVID. So I'm also dealing with, you know, daycare hours and when I can drop off and pick up. And it was just a different mission. And it took me a while to realize it wasn't so much as a noble purpose, so much as a different purpose. And it was, you know, when you're a military officer, it's tangible. Like you have your uniform, you have your publications and your references and the laws and all this different stuff that you have to follow. When you're a parent, you're like, I am trying to make sure I'm doing everything right. And I think I'm doing everything right, but I'm kind of lost in the sauce. And as long as the kids get the vegetables and fruits that they're supposed to eat on their dietary like plan, and as long as they're getting, and then instead of like, you know, showing up for in-serve, I was showing up for, you know, my pediatrician 6 month immunization. So, I was a stay-at-home dad for a little bit. And then we started doing like a part-time daycare where kids were only going not full-time, but part-time. So my wife gives me a hard time. She's like, you weren't a stay-at-home dad. You're a house husband. If the kids aren't home, then obviously you're not a stay-at-home dad. I'm like, fair enough. So I'll go with house husband. But and it was also really lonely too, because my wife did a graduate program out of Ann Arbor and there was no military there. So I was basically just kind of walking the kids around the block, trying to meet the local families in our community. And unless I was in their club, their book club or their soccer club or their kids drama club, we really had nothing in common. And so then I was just kind of alone by myself with no friends. And that was the first thing I realized was I did not have any close networks near me, as opposed to what we had in the wardroom or what you have with the chief's mess or what you have with the enlisted clubs, where they have like, you know, friends and coworkers. And I didn't have that. And so we didn't have any family nearby. So I really was alone and unafraid trying to raise kids by myself and really no good network.
Yep. So,
and I would say that was my biggest challenge, was not having a drinking buddy, not having a gym buddy, not having really anything. And I really struggled with that for the first at least 2 years. And then I would meet people at the gym and it was really just, it was a hard time. Yeah. Luckily, I really loved what I do with my family. I really loved being around them. But it was a struggle personally.
Yep. I think so much of that loss is that, like you said, when you don't have the people you identify with, it's tough because we haven't talked probably for 10 years, or if we did talk, it's been, where are you at now? Or like, okay, you're in San Diego. Okay, cool. It hasn't been like a deeper dive, like what's going on? How are we catching up? Those sort of things. So when you don't, but what I've noticed, even meeting veterans that I didn't serve with, but still, like when you meet a veteran, you have an instant connection and you can like mess around with them more. You can go to deeper levels with them more immediately. Just because they have that connection, that's, I don't know, I sense that. I feel like I talk to them more easily and definitely more open. I'll tell a veteran more things than I'll probably tell probably some family members do.
No, it's a fair assessment. Like when you start talking to veterans, you know, they want to talk about their time in the military and they want to talk about their deployment. They want to talk about how much fun they had. We really do reflect on that, you know, that whatever it is, that 5% of just absolute fun that you had. We never talk about the 95% of duty days and assessments and the inspections and the, you know, the 16-hour days and the, you know, down in the engineering spaces. Or you don't talk about, like, you know, getting hot oil on your face, or you don't talk about, like, you know, sitting in a fan room all day trying to fix something. You don't talk about, you know, listening to an assessor tell you how awful you are. You don't ever talk about that stuff. But you do talk about that time in Suda Bay. You do talk about, you know, that time where you were in Port-au-Prince doing disaster relief. You do talk about those kinds of things. Or, yep, you know, the back-to-back deployments to try to help out people in Iraq and Afghanistan, trying to get, you know, missions and personnel into Afghanistan because of a surge. Or, you know, second deployment. I set off the coast of Libya before Gaddafi was overthrown because we were just expecting one of the embassies to be, you know, evacuated at a notice.
Yep.
So, and I remember sitting off the coast of Libya for months just waiting for that. Months. But we don't talk about, you know, sitting off the coast doing deterrence operations, but we do talk about, you know, wearing the uniform. And that perspective, it really brings home. And the fact that you're like, hey, I was off the coast of Libya, and you're, you know, kids back home are like, where's Libya? Well, I'll show you, because I was there.
True. I mean, that connectability is there, but I guess what I always thought was when you showed up to a unit, a ship, a command, wherever, like everyone got there because they raised their right hand and they swore an oath. Well, before that, so you had a screening process in place. You know, you look to the left, you look to the right, you know, the people said, like, all right, I'm going to do something more worthy than myself, instead of, yeah, we all applied at McDonald's because they paid better than Burger King. Like,
true.
No connection with somebody who's, you're flipping burgers next to. But if you have someone next to you that said, like, we could all die tonight, it's a little different.
The noble purpose and the noble cause definitely reflects on the people who wanted to do that. Whether you got in, you said, I want to just do the 3 years and go, or I want to do 30 years and go. There, yep, was definitely that connection of, let's apply ourselves, no matter how long, to this noble cause, and we'll have that in common forever.
Yeah, and I mean, back in Vietnam, those drafted, I think, had that connection that they stepped up. Now it's a, they stepped up. That was their nobility. We volunteered. That was our, like, pre-screening, I guess.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. For people getting out or listeners who may be considering a transition, do you have any advice, any success tools for finding jobs, marketing yourself, transitioning from, I know how to drive a ship in the middle of the night at 3 a.m. over by Libya, to how in the world that's going to help you build your marketing campaign for your social media to publish your ebook?
Oh man, the question of the transitional veteran. So the transitional veteran needs to understand that what they're competing with in today's technologically advanced, you know, marketing of people and employers, is that you have to be able to correlate your experiences onto your resume. But there's a catch. So in today's technology, in today's media, in today's social platforms, is that a lot of people can get a lot of degrees, a lot of certifications a lot easier than they did 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yes.
And so I transitioned out. We still call it TAPS class. And the big focus that I remember for the two big things they told us in our transitional class was get your VA disabilities correct, because there's a lot of things that you don't understand. Like, you know, make sure everything that was in your record is documented. Even if you only get like 1% or 2% or whatever your disability is, as long as it's documented, because it could have lingering effects 20, 30, 40 years from now. And it's a lot easier to say, hey, I had this 30 years ago documented. It's now giving me problems, and I want to be able to have access to, you know, the VA system to have it addressed, yep. Whether it's knee issues, back pain, even if it's something simple and you say, oh, I'm a totally healthy person, I still want that to be addressed when I start getting older and starts giving me a lot more complications.
And you have gotten older. Jeez.
I have. Why, thank you, good sir. I don't look like it. There's a little bit of salt and pepper in my beard, but that touch of gray, you know, just for men, this is all natural, baby.
Working good.
But they said, the two things they said was make sure your VA stuff was up to date. The second thing was the resume. And we spent, I want to say 90% of my transition in that class on my resume. What I didn't know was yes, your resume is important, but the most important thing is your networking. Because networking, and like when I transitioned out, I was in Great Lakes. So obviously North Chicago and Milwaukee are a little bit different from San Diego or Norfolk or DC.
Yep.
Those networking opportunities are the make or break for you, because essentially, especially as we go to these online platforms for submitting resumes, like I remember I spent weeks submitting resumes, never hearing back.
Yep.
And it's because of the algorithms. Well, if your resume says this, but the algorithm is looking for this, you don't even go into the pile that the HR department's even going to look at.
Yep.
So if you network, then you can actually start talking to the HR reps and the recruiters who are looking for people like you. But because the algorithms don't match that resume, because you did the basic resume, you didn't do the Northrop Grumman resume or the Lockheed Martin resume or the Booz Allen resume, you have to actually start changing those things just so you can get looked at. Yep. Well, I didn't know that. And so I spent weeks applying for jobs that I knew I could do, I could perform, I could strive, I could excel. I wasn't getting picked up. In fact, I wasn't even getting responses. And it was really disheartening. And I have a master's degree. I have a four-year degree with a Bachelor of Science and a master's. And jobs that I knew I was overly qualified for, I wasn't even getting a response from. And that's because I wasn't even in the pile that they were looking at.
Yep.
So I started going to alumni. So I luckily had the alumni association that I could go to and just start sitting down. And once I actually sat down and talked to the HR hiring teams, I actually understood the process in terms of getting your foot in the door. Now, getting your foot in the door doesn't actually mean you get hired, but at least you get into the pile of the people that are going to actually consider for candidates that would get looked at.
Yeah. Cause if you don't get there,
you got to imagine, like if you open up an online application form, the algorithm is going to take those 20,000 applicants and weed it down to maybe like a few hundred. And if you just miss that algorithm by just like one or two sentences,
yep.
You're in the 100,000. You're not in, you know, the 100.
Yep.
And once you get in the 100, then they took it from there and you actually have a person scrubbing through those and who they're going to like draft down in like the top 10.
Yep.
So once I start talking to those, Hired Military does a really good recruitment forum. The Naval Academy Alumni Association and the Service Academy Career Conference is a great forum to go and like actually talk to NAVC or Booz Allen or any type of big defense contractors. or federal law enforcement. So the DEA, ATF, FBI, U.S. Marshals, they all have a big pull towards military because you guys already have, as military veterans, we already have a lot of the firearms training or the understanding of escalation of force. We have a lot of analytical skills that federal law enforcement is begging for. And yep. if you have a mature candidate who can do that kind of stuff, then the FBI would love to have you. The ATF would love to have you. And you already also have a clearance. So yep. they've already vetted you once before. Vetting you a second time for any updates or changes since you left the service is amazing.
Yep. Awesome.
So, and then we also have, when I was in California, we had California Highway Patrol. You had LAPD. In fact, I was actually surprised at how many of my people in my year group or in junior years to me would actually go to enjoy the fire department, because a lot of guys just, they wanted to stay in a local town. They loved the job. They loved the role. They loved the people. They joined, you know, LA Fire Department or, you know, San Diego Fire Department. And it was just something they just genuinely enjoyed and wanted to apply themselves to. It's not, you know, JP Morgan or anything fancy like that, but it was just a noble cause they genuinely wanted to associate themselves with.
Yeah, makes sense.
So my big thing for veterans is, yes, your resume is important, and it's very good to be able to articulate your skills and leverage your abilities against those in the civilian workforce who do go on and get the MBAs or the PMP certifications, but you also have to be able to network and market yourself, because if you're not able to articulate what you can and can't do to an HR team, you just go into not going to even look at pile. So,
yep.
And I did not know that until after I got to San Diego. And then once I was able to do that, I was able to get my foot in the door with one company. And then from there, I did 3 years for defense contracts, doing two different roles. One as a consulting role, one as a program analyst with an emphasis on finances. And the whole way I did that was through networking.
Yep. Makes sense. Awesome. Well, Chris, I enjoyed this show. I learned a lot, and can't believe we were professional for this long.
It was a struggle, man. I had to hold back some good old fashioned sea stories.
We'll get there one day. I think we'll have an entirely different show that we'll have for a different audience.
No, I agree, because we have a lot of good stories, a lot of good laughs, and you know, me branching out from, you know, my first enlisted to when I became an officer to, you know, commissioning and all that good jazz. I do remember a lot of really funny, just slapstick humor kind of moments that really made those 5 years truly enjoyable.
Yep.
So, but also to kind of go back to veteran opportunities, there's a lot of really good nonprofit opportunities, whether it's there's Onward Opportunity. I talk about PMP, like you have your MBA. Well, the big push also for veterans is PMP, your professional, project management professional certification. And Onward Opportunity, please go and look it up. It's done through Syracuse University. Right now, especially with COVID, they do a lot of just purely virtual, and it's free. I can't remember how long you have to do it within. I believe it's within 2 years. Don't quote me on that.
Yeah,
but you can actually get your PMP cert through Onward Opportunity.
Oh wow!
Oh,
cool.
I enrolled into that because I was unemployed and I was trying to, you know, basically, you know, build upon my experiences and try to make myself more marketable. I wanted to learn more. I wanted to actually, like, you know, start articulating my experiences as a division officer into more of a project management supervisor role.
Yes.
And I enrolled and I absolutely had a great time. So I also have my master's, I was JPME qualified through phase one through the Naval War College. And that actually opened up some doors for me as well in terms of networking through the Masters, through the Alumni Association that way. And then there's also a, no kidding, a veteran, God, what do they call it? It's a veteran mentoring program called American Corporate Partnership. And I actually got hooked up with a mentor from Deloitte. And Deloitte has a really good veteran program. They, like them and Lockheed Martin has a really good one. They basically have like internships. Hey, Addie, you want to say hi real quick? So this is my oldest. Addie, say hi.
Hey, girl. Good morning. Oh, not good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
This is my oldest. Addie, can you say hi? No, you have to actually say hi because he can't hear you.
Hi. How are you?
Hey, sweetie. I tell you, you want some snacks?
No. Lori called me stupid.
Lori called you stupid? Mm-hmm. Oh, that's not very nice.
And when I was watching the movie, she started all over again, and also I didn't like it.
Well, Addie, what do we tell her? Do we tell her, Lori, I don't appreciate that. Can you please not do that?
But she did that to my movie.
Okay. Do you want me to go talk to her?
Yeah, she did it to her movie, and I said,
all right. Well, Addie, can you go please tell your sister, I don't like that and I don't appreciate it.
Holy shit, we're fathers.
Oh, man. Dad life.
Dad life. Ladies and gentlemen, Chris Jackson.
Father of two absolutely beautiful, amazing daughters. So... blessed.
Holy.
A lot of sleep lost over these last couple of years, but definitely very happy. My kids are healthy, troublemaking, and I could not be happier.
And you're only going to lose less, more sleep in the future.
Oh yeah.
See,
it's only going to get so much harder.
Father of two boys, I lose my sleep now. I'll sleep great later. I'll do whatever. Yeah. You have the road of four ahead of you.
So I was thinking like jujitsu, maybe some Muay Thai.
Small arms training.
Mm-hmm. Small arms training.
Definitely.
I'll talk to her. Can you give me 5 more minutes, sweetheart? High five. You rock. I love you.
All right, Daddy's got to go.
I wasn't even thinking about what I was talking about. Oh, yeah. So
we'll sign off here.
Sign off here. I wasn't even going to talk about it was really kind of cool because I had a really good experience with this program. It was basically American Corporate Partnership.
So, yep. Awesome.
Do we have time for that? Or are you good?
I think we're good. I think you got to go too.
Yeah. Okay.
And well, you'll be back. This is not your last show.
I gotcha.
I promise.
I have a tattoo of a welcome aboard tattooed straight out of a down Periscope. So,
and that's the tagline, ladies and gentlemen.